Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. On today's episode, we will be looking at Three Kings, released in 1999, baby. If you're new to the podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola filmography to determine, does this film state a case for them to be the greatest film family of all time? To join me to talk about this one and help me answer that question is a fantastic podcast host, interviewer, and just pretty much a bit of a legend, Lee Hutchison of the Filibuster podcast, as well as the Nerd Party's A24 project. We get into some great overlap between A24 and the Coppola family and all types of other greatness. Me and Lee also had a little chat about Nicolas Cage, which you can find over on patreon.com/cagedinpod if you are so inclined. As always, we will be talking about this film in all of its gory inside your body. What a bullet wound detail. So yeah, there's spoilers are plenty. So with all of that out of the way, all that's left to do is to pull a map out of a man's ass, assemble your best team, and go on a treasure hunt for some stolen Kuwaiti gold as we make some Coppola connections. Been said on this podcast before, and it will be said again, I'm sure, that 1999 is argued to be one of the greatest years in film history, and that's where we are for this episode. Today's film stars two ex-rappers, one TV heartthrob turned Hollywood superstar, and a film director, directed by one of the biggest babies ever to direct. Of course, those two ex-rappers are Ice Cube, formerly known as O'Shea Jackson, and Marky Mark Wahlberg. The TV star is George Clooney, and the film director is today's Coppola connection, Spike Jonze, in one of his only acting roles. And the big baby director is, of course, a man known for throwing his toys out of the pram when he doesn't get his own way, David O. Russell. And the film is his satirical Gulf War black comedy, Three Kings. To join me on this mission to see if this is gold or a fool's errand as military puppets is runner, podcaster, and one half of the Nerd Party's The A24 Project, Lee Hutchison. Lee, have you got the power?
I got the power. Yeah, when we did like a little test run to make sure I could hear that audio earlier on, I immediately just started singing along. So yeah, I definitely have got the power. Would I sing that as a karaoke song? I'm not so sure, but it's impossible not to sing along to that song.
I think I would sing that part. I think when it starts getting into the rapping, I would quickly fall down like dead.
I'd probably like mumble a little bit until I got back to the chorus. It's one of these sorts of songs. You'd be in the corner just bopping away and then like, come on, come on, come on. Right, I'm back on a
Yeah. I got the power. And maybe get in with the, oh, I can do that. I can do all that stuff. But I'm too white and I'm too middle class to be rapping, people. Let's talk. Well, I kind of want to talk about, before we get into the Coppola family, I want to talk to you about David O. Russell. Are you a David O. Russell fan, Lee?
I would say I kind of like some of his stuff. When I think of it, when I was sort of like a teenager, I really was big in sort of just spending. I worked in a Tesco. I got like a decent monthly wage. So I would buy lots and lots of DVDs. And a DVD that stood out for me when I was kind of making that transition into like hip indie kid was I Heart Huckabees, mm-hmm. Which is a film I really loved. But then I've seen kind of things like The Fighter, obviously, in American Hustle, but I've got like huge glaring omissions with like The Silver Linings Playbook, Joy. I've not seen much of the older work like Accidental Love, Flirting with Disaster, etc. So I had seen Three Kings, but it's a bit of a spotty record when it comes to his filmography. You know how like Letterboxd shows you how much percentage of someone's work you've seen. Apparently I've only seen 25% of David O. Russell's work, but I've seen the YouTube clips as well. So I think I have a kind of broad perspective of David O. Russell as a filmmaker and a notorious individual.
Well, he's got this kind of, you kind of mentioned his filmography, and it's got these like multiple strands to it. He kind of like, I don't know, he has this almost like bro-y aspect to him with films like Three Kings or like The Fighter almost. And then he kind of has this, I don't know, more soft, gentle, almost like burgeoning Wes Anderson aspect to him with like kind of ensemble pieces like I Heart Huckabees or kind of the quirk of Silver Linings Playbook. So I think like he's a really fascinating director, at least, right? He's kind of got this highly tipped, like star-studded, I think all it's known as is the untitled David O. Russell project that's kind of coming out in the next year or so that kind of looks insane, like who's in it and stuff like that.
Can you think of some of people that you talk about, like Wes Anderson, for example? I mean, David O. Russell with things like Joy, I think American Hustle, The Fighter, I think, or was it Silver Lining Playbook? They've all had like Oscar and Academy Award success in a way that not many of his sort of peers have had in terms of like his filmography. It's not the biggest in the world, but you would say his kind of record is pretty impressive for getting talent and actors and over the finish line. I think what Christian Bale won for American Hustle, did he? Or am I thinking of a different film, or was that Fighter? Probably. And then obviously, I think, what's her name? Jennifer Lawrence. She was nominated as I think.
It's like he's got this, because I think there is that whole thing of like him, Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach were supposed to be like the new kings of like Hollywood, of like New York cinema, kind of making these, because they all kind of started off with these very navel-gazy, like, talking about one slightly problematic director to probably the most problematic director, Woody Allen, was like everyone was kind of touting David O. Russell to be like the new Woody Allen, especially with his like screwball comedy that was covered on this podcast, Flirting with Disaster. And like, I don't know, like it's interesting. And I think Three Kings is a very interesting one to talk about, because it kind of feels like that is the, sends him on like a different trajectory as a filmmaker, because it looks completely different to anything that came before it in his filmography, at least.
Yeah, it was one of those things. I know you talked about 1999 there, and it's impossible not to kind of think about like what an incredible year that was for cinema. But when I think of Three Kings, and one of my first ever memories of it, because I was far too young to see it in the cinema, was that it was one of those sorts of early DVDs. I'm pretty sure I can recall it having one of those Warner Brothers clip cases. Yes. And then I think I remembered having it when it was sort of maybe like 4 years later, was in one of these sorts of silver prestige DVD kind of cases from Warner Brothers, or sort of their premium kind of film range. And I always just remember Three Kings as being one of those early DVDs that you could kind of buy on the shelves as well.
We'll get onto it later, but it's a part of the Warner Brothers Essential War Collection DVD. So yeah, we'll get into whether it deserves that place probably near the end, but I find they all have this, I don't even have it to hand, but this kind of, yeah, like you said, like a silver outlay around it, and kind of like has this, you know, that horrible like standard military font of like Essential War Collection.
Yeah.
So before we get too deep into looking for gold in this film, let's find out some of your Coppola credentials. So when did you first become aware of the Coppola family? And I'm not just talking about it. It probably was a specific person, but I'd like to know that specific person. And then when you realize that there was this kind of massive spider's web like family around them.
I think it's one of those ones I would have to ultimately, like, I would have been familiar with, you know, you kind of look at the Coppola family. There's always standout people, like, get your Jason Schwartzmans, you've got your Francis Ford Coppolas, Spike Jones's, Sofia Coppola. These were all people that I was kind of, I'd heard of the names or maybe saw them, but I didn't realize they were this sort of big nepotism slash incredible family of filmmakers and talent that it really blows your mind. I mean, I knew Francis Ford Coppola first. I always think of my sort of dad having the Godfather movies, and, you know, being that name, it's like it was Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather. It's not just the Godfather.
Yeah, okay.
But I think it would have been about 2003 when you hear of Sofia Coppola as sort of doing Lost in Translation. And it was like, oh, Sofia Coppola and her producer, I think it was produced by her father as well. So you kind of start to go, oh, those two are connected. I never kind of realized that. And then you sort of start to hear about, like, you think of Lost in Translation, it's slightly inspired by her marriage to Spike Jones. So there's another connection there. And then you sort of start to watch some of the Wes Anderson movies and you realize Jason Schwartzman's attached to it. And then you have Roman Coppola, yeah, where I think it was his first sort of ever, you know, the first ever A24 movie. People think about The Bling Ring by Sofia Coppola or Spring Breakers, but it was a Roman Coppola movie that kickstarted it all as well, which no one ever talks about. I mean, it's a pretty terrible movie, but there's all these things that just keeps kind of spawning and spawning out. And even things like your podcast, you know, I've been following it for a while. There's episodes I dip into, I'm like, I didn't realize that was a member of this clan of people, or they were married to someone. And then, you know, behind the scenes magic, I saw this amazing little thing that you'd created where it was like the bloodlines and who was married to who and connections. It was like, I was just looking at it earlier today going, who is that person and how have they achieved that? And I feel like I want to do additional homework now. So I feel like I've known for maybe sort of nearly 20 years about this family. But I think anyone that tells you they knew all about it, apart from maybe yourself, is kind of lying. It is, it's an ongoing experiment, and there's always seems to be breeding going on, or marrying, or third marriages.
Yeah, there seems to be like a whole section of the family, and it's, I'm gonna throw it out there. It's the side of the family that Nicolas Cage is a part of. Like, he's got a lot of like nephews and cousins and brothers and that act and stuff like that, but like it won't come as a surprise to regular listeners, but they're the ones that aren't covered that much because they are the ones very much in like obscurity. Like, you kind of look at their films and they're straight to TV movies or kind of these like low budget horrors and stuff, so they kind of have something for everyone. And it's really interesting you mentioned Roman Coppola, because even when you watch like his first like writing role on a Wes Anderson film, like watching that back now, you realize that Adrian Brody is essentially playing Roman Coppola. And then like you look at those kind of glasses that he'd like, those the sunglasses he wears, like the kind of prescription, like like, you know what I mean, like varifocals or whatever they are, like it's like, and yeah, it's like the whole like Francis Ford Coppola living up to the, that he wants to live up to the memory of his dad. Obviously, in this case, Francis Ford Coppola is still alive. But yeah, it's like all of that seeps in, and it's all fantastic. And I don't know, it boggles. It sometimes even boggles my mind that they're all related.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. You know, I'm so glad that you're doing this series on it, because it is raising awareness of this huge out of control problem that people, you know, I say problem, but that the Coppolas are continuing to infiltrate all levels of Hollywood society, and it shows no sign of stopping. You're doing God's work. You're shining a light on some very underrated films, some films where you like, I can see how this person got credited to do a sort of film. So yeah, it's such an interesting concept of really talented people. And then even someone like Sofia Coppola, fantastic director, but then you sort of see her acting career being kind of started because of maybe that nepotism or being a daughter and kind of failing at it. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of sums up the hit or miss nature if you just looked over these entire broad spectrum of the Coppola family in terms of their hit rate.
Yeah, and I think, well, yeah, even if you look at the kind of patriarch of the family in Francis Ford Coppola, like, he's had, like, for one of Hollywood's greatest directors, has had a pretty, like, hit or miss career. He kind of, like, mm-hmm. is known for that 70s run of classics, and then, like, you get, like, there's still stuff to love in it, but, like, there's stuff in there that, like, and the, like, personally, like, he's bankrupted himself, he's bankrupted companies he's owned just for these kind of follies and endeavors that he just wants to make the films he wants to make. And it's kind of beautiful to see. And I think he is kind of like the lightning rod for the whole family, that some films can work and some films can't. But you mentioned A24, and obviously you host the A24 project. So through that, there's obviously three Coppola films within that. On that podcast, have you ever had the opportunity to meet a Coppola at all?
No, we haven't, but we've had maybe four guests on over the years that I've had worked on Bling Ring and Sofia Coppola's most recent film On the Rocks. And, you know, everyone that's came on, you know, you can't help but ask what's it like to work with Sofia Coppola. And everyone has had so much praise and love for her as a director. She's often been talked about as quite a quiet woman, but she's someone that, you know, a lot of the actors work really well with. And, you know, I even had one there, I think it was the lead actress in The Bling Ring, where she was like, you know, she even wrote her like a letter of recommendation for going off to university. And it's always one of those things that can always be a bit of a worry when you have this idea of a director that you think's really good and talented and lovely. And to hear that, some of those lovely stories you get from people that have worked on the set with them, you know, whether it might be for a day or in a lead role. So no, we've never had a Coppola on. We've reviewed their films. We'll always look to have the guests on and try and maybe shine a light on the type of people that they are and their skill set.
Perfect. So, well, obviously, yeah, he's tangentially a Coppola for the 3 or 4 years that he was married to Sofia Coppola. But what would have been the first film of Spike Jonze's you would have seen? Would it have been in this one acting role he has, or would it have been a film that he directed?
I think probably the first time I was really probably aware of him would probably happen to be going back to Jackass.
Yeah.
you know, he was, if I'd seen this movie maybe before Jackass, but in terms of knowing who Spike Jonze was, it was Jackass. And then sort of filling in the blanks of, like, I would watch his filmography. But there's a thing about Spike Jonze where, as an actor, I look at some of the films he's been in, like he's been in Wolf of Wall Street, Moneyball, The Game, other things like that, and the amount of times you're like, he was in those movies. He has something about him where he blends really well into the background of ensemble pieces or things. He's not a memorable face, but when I think of Spike Jonze, and I'm sure, you know, the Oscar nominated director or Academy Award winning, you know, for all his music and Beastie Boys, all these sorts of things, it's Jackass I think of when I think of Spike Jonze, just this guy that looked slightly out of place with these punks and these slightly idiotic kind of characters. Spike Jonze just kind of looked like the guy that probably had the money, probably should have known better, but was there all along. So yeah, I think of him for that, and everything else is, oh, Spike Jonze did that as well. Oh, Spike Jonze is this incredible filmmaker, but he's the Jackass guy.
There's an amazing Vice like documentary series called Epically Lated, and they look at directors or kind of people who came from the world of skateboarding. So obviously, like, that's Spike Jonze's background. And yeah, there's like another episode all about like Harmony Korine and stuff like that. But like the Spike Jonze one is like really fascinating, because like he himself, like, he doesn't look like it, but he very much is like a kind of like, he's punk. He's got a very punk ethos in like the way he like directs and stuff like that. Like there's loads of like things in his films that if they need like certain shots, he's happy to just jump on a skateboard and carry the camera alongside the actors and stuff like that. And like, I think it's that opening title sequence to the first Jackass with everything like exploding and stuff like that. He did a test run on a girl skate video called Yeah Right that has like skateboarders doing a very similar thing where they're skateboarding and there's explosions going, and there's stories on this documentary of like people's eardrums got blown out and stuff like that, just because he's like, it's punk, well, fuck it, let's just try it out, it's going to be fun. And I kind of like, I love the fact that he doesn't look like the kind of guy to do that. He looks like this kind of, I don't know, nebbish, like, yeah, very like, oh, okay, let's do this. And I think this film's perfect and kind of, I don't know, showing us that punk side of him almost as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just, you know, I think of a lot of the other things that he's done that we'll probably touch on a little bit more. But yeah, it's just one of those things, you almost get the impression he would be like the guy from maybe like a rich family or something like that, where he's hanging out with the kind of the losers, the freaks and so on, and probably annoying his parents in the process. And you kind of think about that sort of period of time where, you know, he was only married to Sofia Coppola for those few years. But the influence of those few years, you know, bring us Lost in Translation, a film people are watching until this day, you know, talking about, which is very much a kind of memoriam on the sort of their relationship and Spike Jonze as a person. And you can almost see that person that would have been in their, you know, what's he was born in 1969. So it's kind of that probably 30s, you know, maybe a slightly arrested development, kind of annoying, you know, going to all these places in the world because he's quite a privileged and a talented guy, and just being dragged along on sort of that ride with someone like that, that probably, as most 30-year-olds would probably be like, for better or worse, but just distracted by a lot of things, hanging around with other people maybe should know better. You know, I think he's, you know, especially when you make a film like Being John Malkovich in 1999, that came out as well.
Yeah,
you know, he hit the big time with that and Three Kings in the same year. You know, no wonder he had sort of a big head and was distracted by a lot of the vices that came to him, probably.
Yeah, there's a story that like some of the puppetry needed to be redone on Being John Malkovich, but Spike couldn't like, or like had to delay it because he's like, I'm actually in like the Californian desert or over in Mexico filming Three Kings right now. And you kind of look at that, it's like, how can this guy go from directing this quite frankly bizarre groundbreaking film to kind of like playing some hillbilly out in the desert, just kind of being offensive and crass. And to your thing of like, we wouldn't have got Lost in Translation. I always think, and it's like, I thank Spike Jonze for the fact that we kind of get a very like, I don't, beautiful is probably not the word, but like a great performance from Chris Pontius in Sofia Coppola's Somewhere as Stephen Dorff's like best like goofy mate. And you can kind of see like, I don't know, like Sofia Coppola's filmography, like a certain aspects of it were Lost in Translation, Somewhere, On the Rocks, all feel like these either autobiographical or at least kind of observed looks at her family and people she knows quite well. And like, yeah, it kind of feels like that nice, like, I don't know, hangover from that relationship is she's got this friendship with Chris Pontius.
I think you make a great point about sort of, especially On the Rocks. I remembered when I watched that for the first time and I came away from that thinking, I know what it must be like to be Sofia Coppola and the daughter to someone like Francis Ford Coppola, like this very elite style character that Bill Murray plays that has a lot of influence, you know, can get into all these swanky kind of New York places, you know, this kind of, you almost get the impression going, I get what that must be like to be her, or to maybe be embarrassed by having a really famous father and to sort of be in that shadow, I think. Yeah. And, you know, talking to things like even Spike Jonze's filmography, what surprised me just doing the research was I always had it in my head that he'd done more movies, like but he hasn't done a directed a film since Her, which is we're nearing 10 years since that, mm-hmm. being John Malkovich, adaptation, Where the Wild Things Are. That's it. You know, he's got more writing credits on Jackass movies than directed films, which blows my mind when you think of how much of an incredible director he is and that hit rate. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of Where the Wild Things Are, but those other three are, you know, all degrees of masterpieces.
Yeah, and there's like, because like I recently picked up, I'm not sure if you remember them, but there was that like series of DVDs that came out, which was like, it's called like the collected works or sort of the complete works, and they're just like 90s
oh, music video DVDs.
Yeah and they like yes. like really thick cases, normally double like
yeah.
dual layer discs, and like so there's like a Michel Gondry one, Chris Cunningham,
yeah. and I can see it on a FOP shelf right now.
Yeah. I recently picked up the Spike Jonze one of those, and just kind of like
nice.
Looking back at like all the kind of like he worked with like icons, like, do you know what I mean? Like Daft yeah. Punk, Biggie, Fatboy Slim, and obviously he has that star turn in the Praise You video as the yeah. kind of I don't know, like preacher dance leader and stuff like that. So yeah, he's an amazingly fascinating guy.
Shooting people or what?
I just wanna celebrate.
I'm talking about millions in Kuwaiti bullion.
You mean them little cubes you put in hot water to make soup?
No, not the little cubes you put in hot water to make soup.
Stay back!
Orders from President Bush!
You open that door now. Where's the gold? Saddam stole it from the sheiks. I have no problem stealing it from Saddam.
Did you inform this gentleman we need a vehicle of some kind?
Can I take?
We definitely take.
Many nations, doors working together.
God bless America! Right. And God bless a free Iraq!
Say, my friend.
Cannot give car.
Okay. I guess we'll buy them.
We can't take you to the Iranian border.
Then we don't have a deal.
We just saved your life.
And we saved yours.
Something happening, yeah.
We can help these people first, and then we'll be on our way.
Bush told the people to rise up against Saddam.
Now they're getting slaughtered.
Warner Brothers presents George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube.
Hello?
Honey, it's me.
Troy? Oh, my God! When are you coming home?
Well, I'm working on that right now, baby.
So let's talk about your relationship with this film. You kind of alluded to how you first saw it, and so yeah, it would have been on DVD, right, in that kind of Warner Brothers clip case. What were your first impressions when you saw it?
It's one of those things. I find that it's why I kind of chose the film. I don't really didn't. I part of me was like, did I ever properly finish it? Did I watch it? Has it been like nearly 20 years since I watched that DVD? And at that time, I was just like most young people in the DVD age, just assimilating so much movies and, you know, access to Sky Movies at the time. Like Three Kings was just a film to me, but one that I've always been sort of interested to kind of go back in, especially with the sort of the cast and, you know, liking David O. Russell a bit more sort of as time's gone on. So I remembered owning it and watching it, and then I think I probably discarded it when I was starting to clear out some of the things that maybe went to a charity shops or a CEX. So when I saw the opportunity to pick this film, I thought, I think it'd be interesting to go back into it, because even watching it at the time it maybe came out on DVD, the visual experience of, well, the experience of watching that before sort of a 9/11 kind of period or a second Gulf War feels incredibly different. And the film feels really crazy to go back and watch now. I mean, even since I picked the film a couple months ago, you know, what's gone on in the Middle East with America has changed again. And you almost think of a film like Three Kings, people don't talk perhaps as much about it as how relevant it is and how much of a critique it is about American foreign policy. When you think about the end of Three Kings, you know, people are essentially marching to their doom and people are trying to save them. And the Americans are like, now we can't help them. There's nothing we can do. We've got to go. We've just had something, an experience like that as we watched unfold at sort of the airport in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And people haven't heeded those lessons. And I think when I picked the film, it was an interesting experience to watch it again and reflect on it. And then watching it in real time as this unfolds in the Middle East was made it all the more richer and quite an interesting film to discuss, I think.
I think what makes it like, and especially within the context of the Coppola family, is this kind of like, and I don't really know if any other kind of that you know, that generation of kind of 90s, they've got a name, I think. You obviously got like the Brat Pack from the 70s or whatever, like the directors, but like that kind of
Sundance Kids or something.
The Sundance Kids, yeah. Like, he seems to be the only one who kind of like really harkened back to that generation before, where that, do you know what I mean? Like, everyone made their Vietnam film. And it's kind of like David O. Russell was the only one to kind of jump on the grenade and go, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to make a Gulf War movie. Like, and like, look at, like, I kind of looked through the list of other films that are kind of based on the Gulf War, and it's not a lot, really. Like, there's kind of like nothing really jumps out to me, like, apart from maybe the Devil's Double, but that's only because I've seen that. Or Jarhead, maybe, but this one like seems to be like the, I don't know, like, so probably people screaming at me going, there's a classic you're missing out, but it seems to be like at least like a film that the biggest film of like the kind, at least first one to really shake the shoulders of people and go, fuck, shit was fucked up.
Yeah, I think Jarhead almost probably sums up why there's not been too many movies about it in a way. I've only watched it once, and I think this is trying to refresh my opening day memories, but it's a thing where it was like, war is boring. That was like the first war where people, when they talk about the Gulf War, I was too young to really, you know, comprehend it as a thing at the time, but it was like bombs being dropped. It was something that was being done over TV. You know, there was very little that the military had to do, so that they almost have to find things like something like Three Kings, for example, where it's like three guys on a side mission off the books that kind of defy orders, and they create their own drama. Or something like Jarhead, where it's like, war's really boring, I want to kill myself, I can't stand just sitting around. And that's probably, it's probably that sort of, it was over so quickly, and you know, it was considered the successful war. And not too much of it, you know. George Bush eventually lost re-election quite quickly after, and we went into sort of that, you know, peace in our time sort of period where people thought we'd reached the, I think the quote is, we've reached the end of history, where the Cold War was over, the Gulf War was over, like, we were at peace and stuff like that. And, you know, the Gulf War just sort of probably just fell in, probably just after that sort of Cold War period ended, and sort of before that 90s kind of stability within the West and the Middle East in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, before I ask you to give us a synopsis for this film, I just kind of want to like talk about an encounter that David O. Russell had with George W. Bush. So obviously, George Bush Jr. It was at a Warner Brothers exec's house, and David O. Russell walked up to Bush and said, "Hi, I'm editing a film that questions your father's legacy in Iraq." And Bush shot back saying, "Well, I bet I'm going to have to go back there and finish the job," which kind of really feels like David O. Russell could have really warned us a bit more that shit was about to get really hairy.
I remember hearing that story. I think it was like a fundraiser or something, because it would have been around the period of of kind of the election campaign beginning, etc. So yeah, I remember hearing that one. And I suppose it's the same with people like Trump and, you know, a lot of other political figures, you know, Boris Johnson in the UK. We probably all knew these people were dangers and hazards long before they even said something like that. And you know, the state of affairs of going into Iraq again is just, you know, it's just an absolute shame and tragedy, the amount of people that were lost innocently, and, definitely, you know, to go under in such pretenses as well. And, you know, it's I think history is not going to be kind to people like George W. Bush, the second Iraq war. And it surprises you almost how little even films there are about it just now. You get things that allude to it, but there's not too many on that second Gulf War. But I think time will come to it. And I think it might be something we might just see more written, that maybe Hollywood doesn't want to poke that bear too much at the moment. Mm-hmm. Or the, it says something maybe about the studio system or the lack of filmmakers, like the Vietnam War, that so many great directors made their films about. What a folly and failure that war is. Where necessarily those directors making the films about that second Gulf War failure?
So, I like to put people on the spot, Lee. And can you give us a synopsis of what this film is about?
Yeah, so following the end of the Gulf War, so technically it's not even a film about the Gulf War, where we're in the post-Gulf War period, a group of American soldiers, Spike Jones, Ice Cube, George Clooney, and the aforementioned Spike Jones, come across a secret map, which has a bunker where the Iraqis have hidden, like Kuwaiti gold. So they decide, we are going to go take that gold. But along the way, they discover that getting the gold is more complicated. And is it actually better to save lives and do the right thing than get rich quickly in the desert? And hilarity and hijinks ensue.
That final line you gave is obviously, like, we've talked about the dourness and the kind of horrors of war. But this film is really fucking fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a hoot and so on. And like, it has a really powerful message and everything like that. But you don't put someone like Spike Jones in the character he is, Ice Cube, even George Clooney at the time, where he's sort of still transitioning from that sort of TV actor, Batman flop. You know, he's quite loose and charming in it. Everyone is, you don't put Ice Cube in a film and don't have him be slightly. There are like four great comedic actors, even Mark Wahlberg, intentionally or not, is always someone that's very, very funny. And you can never tell if he's funny or just a bit of an idiot and sort of maybe a bit thick, and that he just naturally just, you laugh at him as opposed to maybe with him sometimes. Sometimes you think The Departed, you're laughing with him. The film, you're like, this guy isn't the brightest, but he plays that kind of role very well.
So I don't tend to get into like casting what ifs, but we'll get into George Clooney in a sec. But before we do, I wanted to talk about the fact that David O. Russell wanted five other people before he got to George Clooney, and just like, I'll rattle them off, and if there's any you want to kind of particularly talk about, we'll dive. Sorry, into
getting
them.
Into my mind temple. Yeah, I'm thinking.
So we've got Clint Eastwood, Mel Gibson, Nicolas Cage, Jack Nicholson, and Dustin Hoffman all turned down the role as Major Gates.
That's a very 90s list.
Yeah, who in that list? Obviously, there's one that really stands out to me, but that would have. I feel like all of those names would have made this film completely different, right?
Yeah, part of me would be interested to see sort of Jack Nicholson in that role. I think I know who you would pick, and you would still be able to discuss this film on the podcast. Spike Jones even didn't make it, but yeah, it's one of those things like you can't kind of imagine anyone but Clooney. And even at the time, I was very much aware of Clooney's reputation. I mean, I was a young kid that loved the 60s Batman and loved Batman and Robin. Uh-huh. And I thought at the time, you were aware the film was a bit of a flop and this guy was going to have to rehabilitate his career. And he was basically this TV actor that had gone onto this film and it was a disaster. You were aware at the time of like Three Kings and films like Out of Sight being like so important to George Clooney's brand and becoming the actor he is just now. And I almost think if he wasn't cast in both of those films, he wouldn't have followed that through into the 2000s, a growing and more successful director. He would have been probably lumped as the Batman flop and, maybe returned to something like TV.
I think what's like really great about George Clooney in this film is like, he just, I know it's said a lot, but he just oozes this charisma. And I think that's what this film needs. Like, I don't know. I think Dustin Hoffman would have brought like, I don't think he's got that. He's kind of he tends to play more awkward people. And Jack Nicholson's angry. Nicolas Cage, who the fuck knows where that could have gone? Do you know what I mean? He could have especially around this time, he could have potentially got something similar. I don't know, but he doesn't have the kind of like women want to be with him and men want to be him, like, charm that George Clooney has. So yeah, what do you think of George Clooney in this role and like how he kind of deals with the material?
I think he's good, because you would join him in the trenches, wouldn't you? As he's talked about, he's someone that's got that charisma, that charm. He's one of those people, like, he's obviously this guy that's about to punch out of being at war and, you know, leave the army. And maybe with some of the other actors, you can imagine them having that bit more wrinkles on their face, a bit more time in war. They probably would have gone to Korea or maybe even Vietnam. With George Clooney, you sort of get that impression that he's someone that's been sort of dealing with the Cold War, the frustration of that, and this kind of war. And he's done with it. He's ready to kind of go out. And you watch that and you go, I would follow him to go find gold in a QAA and then sort of an Iraq bunker. Like, yeah, I could believe that. And then I think you need that as an audience, because it feels stupid that these people would head out into the desert on a folly like that, you know, and George Clooney makes you believe that you could do that.
I love the way we get introduced to the characters in this film, in like the kind of things they're doing, and specifically the super 90s, like, typing on screen of who everyone is and kind of what they're like, what their role is almost. And that scene we get introduced to George Clooney's character of him shagging Judy Greer kind of in the like, I don't know, what is it, like multimedia like center they have set up in the desert and stuff like that. You kind of know what kind of guy he is from that, right? I think that's what's really clever about it. You kind of know, like, he's fed up with all of this. He kind of wants to move on to the next thing. And he's also like, I don't know. Yeah, he's got that charm, and he's kind of, he is the kind of guy who, as dumb as this idea is, you're going to go, yeah, cool, Gates. Like, let's get to it.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, I would have joined him. I would have been the fifth member of that team.
What do you make? Because obviously it's interesting, because the film kind of like opens up and we're first introduced to Troy and Comrade, who respectively played by Mark Wahlberg and Spike Jonze. And like, you kind of, I don't know about you, but for that first like 5 minutes or so, you're not sure like where the film is going to go, right? Because obviously we're shown it's the end of the Gulf War, so it's like, okay, I thought this was going to be a war movie. Like, what's going to happen, right?
I always think about some films that I think, and I think something, was it called Fury, for example, that I think there's almost this untapped potential in films about that post-war period, about reconstruction or what happens afterwards. Because as we've seen from recent events, there's no clean exit from war. And there's sometimes when you think you've left, you potentially really haven't. And there's a lot of drama that can come from that and decision-making. And I think, you know, something like Fury, I really enjoyed that, because we're so used to the same old stories about war, but sometimes it's interesting to go, but what happened next that wasn't just signing a peace treaty or a deal and so on. And I think a movie like this shows that conflict still went on, that there was huge consequences to, you know, George Bush's like, we want you to rise up and take on the Iraqis. Sort yourself out. And again, history has repeated itself, and it's just so damning. So I think it's a film that is very rare in being this post-war movie that shows there is no sort of clean ending to that. And I think when I watched it back, I remembered it being a war movie, but then as I settled into it, I thought, oh, no, it's that post-war movie, and it's all the more exciting for that.
Yeah, and I think what's really great about that, to that point, is that it gets both like tension out of it and also like some really great laughs. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of thing of like, there's that moment we get when they're like planning what they're going to do to kind of take over this bunker, and they go to like test it out on a cow. Like, this is how you're going to attack it. And it blows up. And then when they turn up to the town, obviously like the Iraqi people are like kind of looking at them going, they're madmen. Look at them. They're covered in the blood of their enemies. Like, like, we can't trust them. And obviously we kind of know them as the audience, as like for all intents and purposes, just four bumbling idiots, really, aren't they? Just kind of looking for this quick buck before they go home.
I think there's something as well that I really like about those type of movies where you talk about it's the end of the war and there's almost this tension that you buy into it where you start to think it's almost like that cop that's like, I'm too old for this shit, yeah. And goes on that last mission. Like you almost feel like if they're at war, there's a tension built in, but there's something about it in your head where you feel like you are so close. You're not in the middle of a war. You're not on the front line at the moment, or, you know, in the middle of about to be a great battle or a Dunkirk or whatever. These are people that, like, you're almost, as an audience member, you're screaming at them going, is it worth getting the gold? Like, go home, go back to your family, get out, save yourselves, because they've made it through this thing. And I've always find that tension of like, oh, don't, it's like going back into the house when you know, for that, you think you survived, you've ran away from the killer, you're going back in. And you're just like, oh no, someone is going to get it. And even though you could die anytime in war, there's just something about it where it's more scary after the fact, I think.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So let's talk about some of the other cast members before we get on to Spike Jonze and his role. What do you make of Ice Cube in this film?
Yeah, I think he's good. I had a feeling he was in it more. I think it's because of the fact that he was one of the characters on the front of the DVD cover. I think, was it George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube were on the cover. I don't think, was Spike Jonze on it? I can't remember. but I almost just remember thinking like he would be in it more, which was a bit disappointing kind of going back and watching it, because I think he's a really good comedic actor and he certainly proved his chops over the years. So I was a little bit surprised how little Elgin was in the film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, he gets these kind of like, he gets some great moments, whether it's like, I love the flashback sequences we get and just that physical acting of like, you just kind of get a glimpse into who he is straight away, just like throwing that luggage onto the conveyor belt as a baggage handler. Yeah. And it's like when they're asked like, well, do you want to just go back to your old lives? And it's kind of his is that. I think Mark Wahlberg's is like, what is it, like a printer cartridge like blowing up on him or something like that. And then we get introduced this like a glimpse of Spike Jonze's character as this kind of like, I don't know, like Joe Dirt looking hillbilly just shooting cans in a kind of like vacant lot or something.
Because you forget about things like that. I mean, I mean, my knowledge of American military is just so broad in scope that when I remember when I rewatched this and when I think about it, it's like these people that were basically office workers were kind of drafted in a way. Yeah, I know that they were on maybe a reserve list, etc. But that surprised me that in that day and age, in that war, they were still having to kind of go down that route for sending people off to war. And that was sort of surprising. I kind of just had remembered them as sort of regular Army Joes and not these people that had lives or baggage handlers or, you know, civilian operators and stuff like that. I was really surprised by that and the fact that they would go. And that feels very, very American. I couldn't imagine that being something we would do here in the UK, us getting called up from our jobs to go fight in Afghanistan.
Yeah, they are on the reserves, aren't they, as well? That's what, like, because I think that's a big part of it, right? It's like, that's what Mark Wahlberg says at one point. So one of the things I really wanted to delve into, but again, before we get to Spike Jonze, is what do you think of the look of this film? Because my DVD, I'm not sure how you watch this, but like it came with a disclaimer that said like that like something along the lines of like, this film, like the color has been done in a certain way to for an effect, like there is nothing wrong with your TV, which like I'm not sure if it is just because an old, I don't know, I'm not sure if it, when it came out on that clip case, there were people going, there's something wrong with this film. But like, yeah, what do you make of the kind of aesthetic?
I'm glad I wasn't the only one. I rented it and I was watching my laptop and I was like, huh, it felt a little oversaturated. It was maybe that period where like you could put film into sort of like a computer essentially and manipulate it on such a grand level that you couldn't really before. And it was maybe one of those ones they had kind of got ahead of themselves a little bit in terms of how you should do that. I think we've got a little bit better. Cinematography has got much better at that. But I could imagine at the time being something like a director, because you look at it and it feels like it was obviously shot on film, but you watch it and you think like, God, that has gone through some sort of like dust or there's something on it. It's probably just been filtered by the cinematography. And I didn't think it looked good, personally. I don't know what it would have been like in the cinema, but I also had that same issue. I was like, this just doesn't feel kind of right. It just felt like the volume levels on the saturation had just been turned up a little too high.
One of the things I kind of like, as much as like it's slightly off-putting, there is an element to it that kind of like you can understand why it's going for it, and obviously like puts it over very much time stamps like when it was made, like that kind of, it feels very like 1999, like that, because it's like I don't know how to just, like the film looks dusty. I think you said like when it kind of like looks like it's kind of been like, because I don't, it's just got this grain to it, right? That, and then it's got this saturation, and it is all kind of, I think the way I'd explain it is it looks like it's filmed on a fisheye lens when it's not, almost. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of got that feeling to it.
I'm reading it here. I've got a note where, much to Warner Brothers' annoyance, no surprise there, there was kind of experimental techniques used. So obviously the film was shot on a sort of ectochrome transparency stock that was cross-processed in color negative chemicals to reproduce the, quote, the odd color of the newspaper images of the Gulf War. Wasted on me. Though the process produced a unique quality and look to the film, that's a way to put it, it was exceedingly unreliable to develop, and many film labs would not provide insurance for the transparency stock if it did not develop properly. Russell feared that scenes would need to be reshot until finally a lab had found that would develop the transparency stock to the negative chemicals. So the opening shot of the is on controversial negative stock and bleach bypass to give a deep black and high contrast look. And some interior shots were also filmed on conventional negative stock and processed normally. Russell also credited the realism of the firefight, so yeah, a lot of odd techniques and a hell of a gamble for an indie director. And you would get away with that these days. You know, a $50 million war movie in the hands of an indie kid, you wouldn't imagine them getting away with something like that. Obviously, with digital, it makes it a little bit easier to play with things like that. But, you know, imagine if they had to reshoot that film. Like, it would have been, you know, double the budget and it would have just scraped by. But that's quite impressive, really, that he could get away with that, and he could beat Warner Brothers down like that.
Yeah, for kind of like how it's aged, like, and how it looks now. I haven't watched it on, like, well, it was just a DVD. I'm not sure how it looks on like 4K or anything like that. Even if it's had a 4K release, but like, I kind of gotta give it to them for taking that kind of gamble. Do you know what I mean? And it very much is that thing of, we're gonna make, we want to stand out, right? We want to make a film that is going to like be quite polarizing about this, as much as it's set in the post war era. It's very much speaking directly to what that whole war is about. And there's obviously moments in it. They're on a mission to find gold, obviously, like, and then there's that very big moment when, Mark Wahlberg is being interrogated by a brilliant like French actor. Where is his name? If you know it, Lee, please do jump in.
Yeah, my mind is drawn a blank. I always just think of it as the CD guy.
Yeah, it's Saeed Tagamori, who was in La Haine, I think was the first film I remember seeing him in, and like really like stood out to me, the brilliant French film. But like when he pours the oil into his mouth and he delivers that line, like this is like the reason you're here, like this is the reason you're here, not like the kind of keeping the peace like they've been fed by George Bush.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Spike Jonze. What do you make of Spike Jonze in this film, Lee?
So funny, isn't he? I completely forgot what his performance was going to be like. So it was a pleasant surprise where he plays the bumbling village idiot. He plays it so well, doesn't he? I thought he would be in it more. But yeah, I enjoyed this one quite a lot from Spike Jonze. I think he has got great comedic timing. And I think even as a director, you see that in a lot of his films where he can bring out in people like, say, Nicolas Cage in Adaptation, just the slightly odd, humorous style of people. Like, it's just always slightly awkward, slightly weird. With this, it's a little bit broad than the sort of niche comedy I almost associate with him and his kind of style probably as a director.
So yeah, like some of the like moments we get with him, like he kind of like I wish we'd have got more of it as well, the interplay we get between him and Ice Cube. There's that great scene when they're riding in the car kind of arguing about what to listen to, and like he's kind of going, hey man, we gotta listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd, and he's like, and Ice Cube's very much, no, we gotta listen to like chill out anthems and stuff like, or like kind of easy listening anthems and stuff like that. And I think that stuff's great. And he, like, as much as he's not on screen, he even gets like, he gets this great little arc to his character, in that kind of like he starts off just very much in the shadow of Mark Wahlberg's Troy, and kind of like is very much like the stereotypical like person you would imagine being in that war, where it's like, even when they kind of team up with the kind of rebels, as it were, like to take on this kind of final bunker, he's still just saying, like, when he's asked questions about, oh, does he want to just kill as many Arabs as possible, he's like, yeah man, that's what we're trained for and stuff like that. And it's like, and you've got Ice Cube again, that kind of great comedy interplay where he's like telling him, like, he's like, don't listen to him. Like, he's a redneck. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
I'm thinking about his butt cheek in my head still. Like, yeah, like with the map in there. It's like, oh gosh, like it's just so kind of crass as well. As you see, it's sort of like that reputation of that village idiot that's gone off to war, and God knows how they've kind of got there, but they're there, and it's as much a kind of fun escape as it is a duty to serve almost.
What I love about it is he's not the dumbest character we get in this film either. That honor goes to Jamie Kennedy, right?
Yes.
So is there any particular scenes in this that you think like really stand out to you and that you'd really like to shine a light upon?
Yeah, I think for me it's the torture scene with Mark Wahlberg that you kind of alluded to, with like the, you know, I've never seen a CD used that way to, you know, as they're putting oil down it, where it's one of these ones where we see it so many times, and that people will say, we're going to war for this very specific reason. It's noble and just, but we can see through it, you know, like, why did we go into certain places? It was to chase oil, you know, and, you know, the fact that he's shining a light on that, and that people almost, we in the West are so quick to talk about China and the Middle East, or maybe religious people, is that all brainwashed? What are they doing? You know, they're fighting for a cause that doesn't exist. Can't they see the light? And the amount of times, resources, money, and lives wasted that of American soldiers that have been sent off to war to kind of do something like that, that they think they're doing something righteous, when in reality they're there to help with oil and exports and things like that. And it's so transparent. And it's interesting to see that shone on to someone like Mark Wahlberg, where you think of people that like Mark Wahlberg, and I like Mark Wahlberg, but he has this, he probably almost has that attraction to a lot of people of the working Joe, blue collar guy that will go see him in any sort of film and his comedies, whether it's Daddy's Home or Transformers or The Departed. People love him and his daft TV show and his show about his family business doing burgers and stuff like that. You know, he isn't, he's respected by a lot of people, but his following is perhaps the sort of people that would maybe go to war or to sign up for things like that. Yeah. And, you know, the message in this film is so strong, and it was ignored by so many people that in the years that followed, for almost two decades plus, went off to war for these exact same reasons that were maybe targeted behind keeping the homeland safe or getting weapons of mass destruction, or we're going to save the Kuwaiti or whoever. Like, the lessons of this film went over people's head, and that scene is, it's literally shoving it down the throat of our lead character and our audience member, having time passed since the end of that Gulf War. And no one heeded that lesson. A lot of people did not heed that lesson of Three Kings and lost their lives because of it, or were sent off to die a pointless death in the desert, really, is my feeling.
I think what's really interesting about that is it kind of like begs the question of like, what is the way to kind of get that message across in film? Do you know what I mean? Like, there is always, I think, like an argument for kind of like wrapping some, like a serious message up in something like quote unquote fun. Do you know what I mean? Like, because like in a way, like having someone like Mark Wahlberg and Ice Cube, you can see like this film's intention, because it's like, not only are we trying to like by putting it in this packaging of something that is like an action adventure film and a comedy, we've got a lot to say. And like like you said, it's a real shame that that kind of like fell on deaf ears. And I think like a film that kind of like in recent years that really tackles like a big subject, but does it in a way, and it feels weird to almost call it fun, like something like Promising Young Woman, where it's like it has this kind of, do you know what I mean, it has a fun element to it, but tackles something that is like an epidemic, like in regards to like sexual abuse and stuff like that. And it's like, I think it's more a cultural thing, right? It's like in 1999, I don't think people were ready for that in their popcorn, almost. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think the cultural and like consciousness, consciousness has kind of expanded, where people will take that kind of medicine with their sugar.
And it's maybe one of those things, you think back to 1999, you know, the well for film discussion was much more small and limited. You had your key critics, you had maybe your Siskel and Eberts, you had your top critics. It was one of those things, like films were reviewed and then they sort of went into the world. And, you know, I can't really speak to 1999 because I was seeing films like Star Wars at the time or a new James Bond film. I was too young to be seeing much more else than that in the cinema. But you think of something like Promising Young Woman, you can watch it at home. You can go see it obviously didn't get released in the cinema then, but you watch a film like that and you can have a conversation afterwards about the meaning behind it, dive into it, discuss it. Something like Three Kings, I've never really seen it on streaming services much. I know it's on like Sky Movies. It's one of these movies that its message was certainly timely at the time, or a warning and a reflection on it. But there wasn't maybe those conversations where people are like diving into or think pieces afterwards, or how many podcasts do you see chatting about Three Kings, or Three Kings 1 minute at a time, or you know, the legacy of Three Kings 20 years ago. When people talk about 1999, there's The Matrix, there's Magnolia, there's Star Wars, there's a load of different films, but no one talks necessarily about this one. So it just kind of seems to have just got lost, and that message that it said hasn't really got out perhaps into the wider world, or been discussed or reflected on, or ultimately we're in a partisan time where people will go to war anyway for it. And the people that would look at that and go, well, America is actually the villain in it, you know, in its behavior, you know, these people are outliers really in the grand scheme of things. Why not, why America should perhaps be looked down upon? And again, you wouldn't necessarily get a film like this where America's the villain, you know, for a $50 million dollar Warner Brothers movie off to the cinemas.
Yeah, and I think, like, I don't know, like, I'm kind of glad that this podcast, however many people listen or whatever, like, is shining a light on this film somewhat, because like you mentioned earlier, it's like, unfortunately, it's still like the message is still prescient, whether it is like that war was bad, like the kind of ongoing involvement both the US and the UK have played in the Middle East, and like especially like Afghanistan and Iraq and stuff like that. And it's like you said, there's the ending of this film has basically been happening over the last few months in the kind of exit of Afghanistan that we saw. And it's, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe with an upcoming David O. Russell film, you'll see these people going, you know what is an underrated David O. Russell film that we don't talk about? Three Kings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to see that happen.
So, we've kind of alluded to that ending. So, like, what do you think that the what like? Yeah, what do you think the kind of ending tells us almost, and like, what do you think it's like, the grand, obviously you've gone into some of the messaging of this film, but what do you think that ending really tells us about America, or just what David O. Russell was trying to tell us?
I think it's one of those ones, I almost think of that meme of like the Mitchell and Webb show of like, are we the baddies? Where it's one of those ones, like, I always go back to that line when I was watching it, where it was like, George Bush said that we should rise up as Kuwaitis and fight back, and you're not protecting us. Like, they've essentially just created chaos for the sake of it, like a war very much under false pretense. So we've got to help the Kuwaitis, we've got to do this. And you just see at the end where they have a chance to save some refugees, which is the most simple act that you can ask of a nation, of soldiers, of anyone, is to make sure people are safe. And especially in a position where they're, again, they're so close to having their lives saved. And you have these American officers looking to stop that. And they almost have to be bribed to kind of let it happen. And yeah. You know, the fact that they get court-martialed, and it's only because of this like news story in the end that it gets out there. And then the amount of things that have gone on over the years, and we've heard about so many horrific, you know, acts of war that have been done, or horrible acts that have been done upon to innocent people or refugees or prisoners of war. And you watch something like this and you go, these are sometimes the stories, could have been a story that we didn't hear about. These great people that were almost condemned to death that we asked to go and fight on our behalf and to do something good, and we would protect them. And we were going to let them die because we were done with the war, yeah. And so on. And, you know, thank God that there was that news story there to shine a light on it, or else they would have been, you know, they would have been court-martialed and probably sentenced to military prison, and their lives would have been ruined. They wouldn't have been reunited with, you know, family members and young kids, for example. These people did the right thing. And that's all we should ever ask of people, especially in a crisis like that, especially one of our own making. And you see that over the years again. How many times have we turned our back on people whose lives and lands we bombed and destroyed? And I think David O. Russell is really shining a light on America ain't that great. And as you say, similar to the Vietnam Wars, you know, none of those films really try and romanticize that involvement. Mm-hmm. It's a shame and a disgrace.
What I keep thinking about the ending of this is, if they don't have that bargaining chip of the gold bullion, then those people would have died. And it very much comes to the kind of like the money that flows through the like military industrial complex and stuff like that. And it's that kind of changes the opinions of the officers and stuff like that to let them go. And throughout the film, what I find is quite interesting as well, is we, even our kind of heroes, like, you still see traits of that kind of, I don't know, grey areas in their character. Like, there's that whole scene where they're trying to like rouse up like the Kuwaitis to kind of to join them, and I think they're like there's a scene where like they're going, oh, George Bush needs you and stuff like that, and they're still doing a bit of that. And I think Gates gets called out as well by Cliff Curtis's character, and he's like, well, all you really want to do is come here and steal the gold, do you know what I mean? And it's like, you don't actually care about us. And it's kind of like, you get that great, that's the thing, Mark Wahlberg, as much as like he's done some terrible things in his past, like, and like love him or hate him or whatever, like, he delivers a really great scene in this when he's eventually kind of like freed by Gates. He like what is interesting, he spares the guy who's tortured him, and then he has that exchange with Ice Cube where like I think Ice Cube mentions like, that's going to be a tough task to try and get all these people over the border. And he says to him like, well, do you want to go around, it's your job to go around and tell everyone like, we can't take you, like we're going to just have, we have to leave some people behind. It's like, very quickly you just get the, okay, yeah, I get it, yeah, we're gonna have to get all these people across the border, because that's what really matters. And it's, I don't know, yeah. And sorry, I'm rambling here, but to your point of the media, I really wanted to like talk about that, because that's another thing that makes this film so prescient, right? That kind of like, we're living in this, like, whether it's film the police kind of age, or kind of like, do you know what I mean? If there's injustices, you can just pull out a camera phone and like you can film it and shine a light on what is going wrong. And it's, I think this film definitely does need to be revisited, revised, and kind of like, I think whether it's the Gulf War or kind of other things like the tragedy of like George Floyd's death and stuff like that kind of thing. Like, would we have seen justice in that case? Like, if it wasn't for somebody filming it, do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like the media and like reporting is now in the hands of the people. And I think like, yeah that was said in this film, what, like 22 years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah. And I'm listening to you talk and I'm almost imagining replacing with Kuwait with like Afghan airports and things like that. And we're just gonna have to leave you behind, sorry. And it is just so tragic. And you know, it will happen again and again. And you know, America may not be at war now, but they will find a reason or excuse to be at war with someone somewhere someday. And you know, who knows what will happen.
Well, before we kind of wrap up talking about the film, one of the things I wanted to kind of just touch on is we get these kind of great cutaway scenes throughout the film, whether it's the kind of like depiction of what would happen if you were shot and the kind of thing of sepsis when Mark Wahlberg's shot and we get the interiors of his body when he's tortured and we get those like great moments, well not great, but like those kind of, well yeah, filmically they're great, of like these sometimes brutal flashes of either things that happened or could happen. And whilst watching this, it kind of reminded me that David O. Russell almost like created the template for what Adam McKay's doing now, like that kind of like that genre of filmmaking. This very much feels like the touch point for that, right? Do you know what I mean? Like that pitch black comedy with a harsh political message.
Yeah, I mean, I know Adam McKay has got his detractors, but I'm a big fan. I loved Big Short, Vice. I can't wait to see his new one. What's it called again?
Sound like This Way Up or something like that, or like,
yeah, Look Up or something Up. Yeah. And it's just one of those messages where it's like, I suppose sometimes the problem with Adam McKay movies is they're appealing to a converted audience already. Yeah. In a way. It's not like he's brought along the audiences of the Step Brothers and stuff like that. People that are watching Vice or his next movie about this meteor strike, about how idiotic politicians are. We already know that message. And how many people are going to change their tune or realize, oh, yeah, no, I got something wrong with there. But no, I definitely see that connection. And, you know, I can almost imagine someone like Adam McKay being inspired by that work for sure.
Amazing. So, yeah, a couple of questions I wanted to ask you before we wrap this up is, how do you think this like fits within the war movie genre?
It's not a genre that I'm too strong on. It's never been something I particularly seek out or something like that. But I think, as I kind of maybe touched on earlier, I like that it's a post-war movie. You know, what happens when you've made the decision to leave and the fallout from that war doesn't end just because you agree a peace treaty or something like that. There is still a lot of mess that's been there. You know, people are often staying there in sort of peacekeeper roles or providing a sort of military overview, and I find that quite interesting. That is a rare genre in itself, about that post-war period and how we kind of navigate that, and maybe the people that are left behind whose feelings are going to be drastically hurt by going, look what you've done to our lives, and now you're pissing off back to America.
Definitely. And the other thing I wanted to talk about as well is I mentioned at the beginning that this is a part of the Essential War Collection released by Warner Brothers, which also includes The Battle of the Bulge, Escape to Victory, Full Metal Jacket, Kelly's Heroes, Memphis Belle, The Dirty Dozen, and Where Eagles Dare. I'm not sure if you've seen all or any
I've
of those
seen
films.
Full Metal Jacket. I'm pretty sure if I asked my late grandfather, I think he would have had most of those on a VHS collection, or probably fell asleep to them most on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah, I can just picture that DVD set perfectly, just being on the shelf at a Virgin Megastore. And yeah, the only one I ever picked up, I think I picked up the Full Metal Jacket edition and the other one, but the others felt like too old and antiquated. I always wanted to see like, what's the hip indie movies or like the Otters, you know, your Stanley Kubrick. So yeah, I've not seen the other ones.
Well, I think that like, yeah, like Full Metal Jacket was the one that jumped out to me. And this, like, you can see that lineage from Full Metal, like Full Metal. I think the lineage of films that kind of go into this is, I can see Apocalypse Now somewhat, like, because that's kind of got that, like, I don't know, like, where Apocalypse Now is kind of almost like psychedelic in the way that it kind of like shows the Vietnam War and stuff like that. And it kind of feels like David O. Russell is doing like the 90s equivalents of that. So what would that be like? The ecstasy version with these kind of cutaways and this kind of bright imagery and stuff like that. And I think there is this Full Metal Jacket aspect to it. He's very much coming from that angle of the kind of like, we done fucked up. Do you know what I mean? Like, America haven't done good in this war.
Yeah, and then 2 years later, back there, and it's almost like why that film has sort of fallen maybe through the cracks, like the Vietnam War, World Wars. They're almost in a defined period of time of this happened.
Yes.
Whereas by the time sort of America reflected on that period of time or had movies to say about the Gulf War, it was back into the Middle East again, and new stories had to be told, new lessons had to be learned again, etc. And it almost became one of those things of like, not really anyone talks about Gulf War One because it was just played out on the TV. That yes. seems to be how people describe it, of like the first war on TV, you know, in cable TV, etc. And then, you know, we spent 20 years in there, and it's almost like the stories that are now going to be told in the coming years and months are going to be about the people that were involved in that.
Definitely. So as we wrap things up, I always like to see if there's any Coppola connections in this film. Mm. Are there people who worked on screen or behind the camera who have worked with the Coppola family somewhere else down the line? Did you manage to find any, Lee?
Yeah, the one that stood out for my head, I've had such a busy day at work, I would have like loved to have dedicated hours and hours to coming up with the most obscure ones. But I'm going to go with one that would be like, if this was like the pointless TV show, most people would get. But obviously George Clooney was in Fantastic Mr. Fox from Wes Anderson, that also starred Jason Schwartzman. So there's the easy tap in choice.
Perfect. I'll see that, and I'll raise you a George Clooney in a cameo performance in A Very Murray Christmas, which was directed by Sofia Coppola.
Excellent choice, yes.
And I'll rattle off the other ones. So we have Mark Wahlberg, who is in I Heart Huckabees, also directed by David O. Russell, and also stars Jason Schwartzman and his mother, Talia Shire. We have McKelty Williamson.
I just realised that's his mum. I did not know that. My God. Christ, you learn something new every day. See, I'm still learning.
So, yeah, we have McKelty Williamson, who I think a lot of people would know as Bubba Gump from Forrest Gump, who plays Colonel Horn. He is in Con Air as, like, kind of the diabetic best friend of Cameron Poe, obviously played by Nicolas Cage. Cliff Curtis, who plays Amir in this, the kind of, like, the leader of the Q-80 rebels, as it were, is in Bringing Out the Dead the same year alongside Nicolas Cage. Saeed Tamagori is in I Heart Huckabees as well, with the same connections. And wrapping it up, Judy Greer is in Adaptation, Jurassic World, and the 2019 remake of Valley Girl, which obviously doesn't have Nicolas Cage in it, but the original is Nicolas Cage's first starring role. And wrap it up with Carter Burwell. This same year did the soundtrack score for Being John Malkovich. There we go. That's the Coppola connection.
So you've won pointless.
There's probably more. If there are, yeah, hit me up, guys. Let me know, and I'm really bad. I should have known that. There's only so much time in the world to look these things up. So let's score this film, Lee. And I like to do that by asking you, what is your perfect wine pairing for this film?
I like wine. So I was thinking, like, you're in the desert. So red wine would be the worst decision in the world. So you probably want a sparkling wine or something like that. Something where you can almost just picture the little droplets popping down the side of a wine bottle. Where you can almost just parched in the desert, have it and just go, ah. So I would have to say a sparkling wine fresh out of the chiller.
Perfect, perfect. And it very much feels like that would be on the menu for the characters in this film, especially it being the end of the war. So obviously, if you're paying for that wine, is it a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf wine, aka is this film any good?
I think I'm going to say it's a middle shelf, and I'm not saying that as like a negative. I think you get fantastic wines for like 7-8 quid. And Three Kings is a really good film. You know, when I watched it yesterday, I think I rated it like 3 out of 5. But you know, it's like, it's these things where you talk about it, you dive into it, you hear different opinions. And you know, I'm certainly going to update that rating on Letterboxd. But I would still have it as a middle shelf wine. But that middle shelf wine is in. Go to Aldi, Lidl, you get great wine. You know, my favorite wine to enjoy is an £8 Sauvignon Blanc from Sainsbury's. And that is no bad thing. So middle shelf and proud.
Well, yeah, I think there's very much like a kind of three stars sometimes is seen as bad, but it's like three stars is what you're watching the most in your life. And it's like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you reserve the fives and maybe the fours for the masterpieces. But I very much think that like three is a mark of like, it's solid. And I think like that is what Three Kings is. It's solid. It does what it does. It does what it does well. And it's like, I don't know, like, it's in and out, even though it's like close to 2 hours. It kind of like, it's got enough momentum in it to just kind of keep you interested and engaged. And it's, it does that great thing of packaging a serious message within a whole lot of fun. And I've got a lot of time for it.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So let's move on to probably my favorite part of the podcast, where I ask some questions that don't really mean anything, but they're absolute torture for my guests, and it's quite fun to do. So, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies of the entire rest of the family?
It's a very, very tough one. There's one of those ones, it's like, I'm a huge sci-fi fan, especially Star Trek, and I've learned that if you pull one thread, you inadvertently destroy time and so on. So like, this question has me thinking I'm going to destroy the universe, killing majority of the Coppola family and probably wiping out cinema. But I love Wes Anderson films a really hell of a lot. So I'm probably going to have to keep Jason Schwartzman just so I can keep most of that filmography intact. And I'm due to see the French Dispatch in a couple of weeks. I just bought a ticket to the French Dispatch exhibit, pop-up exhibit that's going to be in London today. So I've made an investment of time and effort in seeing this movie in the coming weeks. So I feel like that I've got to keep that alive. So I'm going to keep Jason Schwartzman alive so I can keep Rushmore intact and so on, and quite a lot of the other Wes Anderson films. Like, if it was just Darjeeling Limited, he can go, but I need to keep that. But I feel really bad for Sophia, Nicholas, Francis. You know, a lot of great people have just been wiped out from existence. But I'm sure you would pick Nicholas Cage, so we kind of even out.
I'm just gonna say, with your decision you said about the wider ramifications of it, you've just said goodbye to Star Wars, I reckon.
I'm not fussed about Star Wars. I'm always a Star Trek guy. Star Wars is totally overhyped. Go away. It's gone. It's fine. You know, cheerio. There's too much of it. You know, move on. Disney can spend $4 billion on something else instead. They can spend that on making like $400 million. Was it $4 billion? They can make $4 billion Moonlights, for example, with that money. So I am making sure Disney invests their money in a better way.
Perfect. I love, I've said it many times on this podcast, but I love when people's answers to that question are wholly selfish. And I applaud you for being wholly selfish with your answer, Lee.
Not quite right. Like, it's not, that's my response. Everything's always objective, you know. you know, history will judge other things. So I can only say what I like.
Perfect, perfect. Yeah, I don't know. I think Jason Schwartzman as well is making a strong case to be kept in this as well. I think he rivals Nicolas Cage for the most screen time with his kind of work in both film and television, because obviously, like, you've got like full seasons of shows he's in and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you would have never have got the amazing theme song to The OC without Jason Schwartzman writing it.
My God, see, again, I didn't know that either. See, like, there's so much, like, if you untangled that, you know, who would be sitting there thinking, like, Channing, California, you know, my God, I'm learning so much
today. Yeah, go back, and I say this to you and I say it to anyone listening at home, go back and watch the music video to that song, and you see a little fresh-faced Jason Schwartzman sitting at the drum kit, drumming along. He's a founding member of Phantom Planet, everybody. I love sharing that fact. So based on this film alone, Lee, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
You'd probably have to say so, wouldn't you?
But based on this film alone.
No.
There you go. That's Spike Jonze has rightfully been kicked out of the family because his contribution has not made them the greatest film family.
His hairy arse is just, I prefer more prestige cinema. You know, I don't want to see a map between some guy's butt cheeks. No.
Amazing. And we've talked about this film quite a bit throughout the podcast, but it's possibly the most important question on the whole thing is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
No Time to Die is in cinemas from tonight. Probably just like, tell your husband how you really feel. I mean, it's one of those things that I was lucky enough to see this in the cinema when I was younger, a really good indie cinema up in Aberdeen in Scotland. And it was never a thing as far as I was concerned. And the same with something like Ghost Story, for example, where there's so much debate and discussion about what was in the note, what did he say, you know. I've never been like bothered about that. Like, I've accept and go, that's a lovely moment, and I just accept it on face value and it's lovely, and I don't need an answer. Or if I was in their company, I wouldn't waste my time almost asking them, because you just know they're always going to turn around and say no. So it's never been an issue for me. I leave that for other people, but I think it would just be something like, tell them how they feel. And I wouldn't want to know if there was like an expose or Bill Murray decided on his deathbed to reveal the answer.
Yeah, I think there's been a whole thing where people have like got lip readers involved, like tried to figure it out and stuff like that. And it's I just like it as an end to this podcast because it's open to interpretation and kind of it's a chance for people to make a joke a lot of the time. Whether a popular one at the moment is sue Disney for whatever you can get.
Oh yes, and Hail Hydra for that long period of time as well.
That's amazing, Hail Hydra.
That's a good one.
I love it. Well, Lee, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've made so many Coppola connections during this as well, and I'm my mind is blowing. It's a good way to leave a podcast.
Well, yeah, before I do let you go as well, sell your wares, like plug your podcast. How can people keep up to date with what you're doing over on the A24 project or anything else you're doing?
Yeah, you can find me on Filibuster, which is a general sort of film and culture podcast that we've got. We've got the A24 project, which is probably like almost like a spiritual cousin to the type of show that you guys do here, where we've gone through the entire filmography of A24 by and large to date. And we interview people along the way, you know, about what it's like to work on these projects, their film stories, much like you guys, well, you did, there's no guys here, and that you did with something like Pig, for example, and getting people on the way to what's it like to work on these projects and with these people. You know, we've had like David Lowry on, Bo Burnham, Millie Shapiro, you know, loads and loads of guests over the years. And we always feel really lucky with the people that we're able to get. So, you know, check us out there. And they're good shows, I think. I'm quite proud of them.
It's a fantastic podcast. I recently watched Zola and was like,
just, Zola's so good. I've got an interview dropping on Monday with the guy. This is why we're almost spiritual podcast cousins. I've got an interview coming out on Monday with a guy who's in one scene in Zola where he's the first guy to come up to the hotel suite and have sex with her. and he has got this fantastic story and basically just spends the whole podcast talking about how dope everything is. And he swears a lot, but it was so fantastic to hear what it was like for him to be in this scene and to like, basically his scene is having a sex scene with Riley Keough. What's that like? What's that like as an actor to try and do scenes like that? So we've got that one dropping on the Monday coming, depending on when this podcast come out, and we had the director as well. So we always try and shine a light on those people that have the smaller roles in something, or you might blink and miss them, but what's their story and journey to films like that? And I always think that's why I quite enjoy Coppola Connection. It's like, that person's in that. Let's dive into it. Let's really, you know, I've had one or two guests somewhere where they've had like, I was only in a small scene. I might not have much to say, but sometimes those are the best podcasts where you can just really dive into someone's journey and what it was like to just be a day player on a Nicolas Cage movie or an A24 film and what's that like for them in life afterwards.
Yeah, I recently interviewed Sky Elabar, who's most known for being in The Greasy Strangler, but I got approached by him. He just DM'd me once on Twitter and said, "Hey man, I did four commercials with Roman Coppola, so like my like that kind of thing excites me more than going after, I don't know, speaking to Sofia Coppola almost or actually one of the members of the family." I'm like, This is weird. People are kind of, people listening at home will be like, why the, like, has he broken the rules? Why has he got Sky Elabar on? And then you listen to the podcast and go, Jesus Christ, because like none of that, like adverts aren't listed on IMDb or anything. Yeah. Well, they've got their own kind of weird, like commercials, IMDb and stuff like that. But like,
exactly. And it's always about these things. I think when you have like a platform, it should be about shining the lights on that. Like, it would be so easy to do a podcast where you're like, you have all these big names and you can get them sometimes, but it's always like those people where you watch a scene where you go, oh, they were in that scene, and you come away all the richer for that experience. And you're shining a light on an actor that you might not have heard about or seen about, but I bet they've got an exciting story to tell about working with a director like that. And you know, when you get guests like that, they're coming on for the love of film and conversations and the work that you've done. They're not coming on for payment or anything like that. Exactly. And that's what podcasting should be about.
Amazing. Well, yeah, back to my original point, what I wanted to say when I saw Zola was that makes the A24 project so special is I was just itching to speak to somebody about that film and lit like and kind of like my interpretations and just kind of like my feelings about it. And I sated that feeling by listening to your podcast and kind of getting to hear like interviews with the director and stuff like that. So yeah, from me, man, you guys are doing some fantastic work and
I'm right back at you.
the
Breadcrumbs Collective are smashing it.
May the A24 I don't know, may they reign supreme forever so you guys continue doing what you're doing. Again,
and likewise with the Coppolas, keep breeding.
Thank you so much, Lee. Again, thanks for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Anytime.
Again, a massive thank you to Lee Hutchison for coming and joining me for this episode and answering the question, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time? Thank you very much for listening. It always really, 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 really means the world to me that people are listening. And if you are listening, let me know. I do like to know that you're out there. Sometimes I get paranoid and feel like I'm screaming into the void. So you can get in touch with the podcast on all the social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd, all at Caged In Pod. Or if you want to, I don't know, declare your love for me, you can always hit me up on an email. You want to send something private. You want to have, I don't know, you want to, you think that this podcast is actually Nicolas Cage and you want to email me, you can do at cajuninpod@gmail.com. Look forward to interacting with you and explaining to you multiple times that I'm not Nicolas Cage, and then you asking me, how do I get in touch with Nicolas Cage? And me going, well, it's a lot harder than you think. I've tried and it doesn't work out how you think it's going to work out. As for next week on this show, I know as of lately we've been kind of messing around in the multiverse of where this podcast goes and what it does in revolving. Is it a Nicolas Cage episode? Is it a Coppola Connections episode? Well, next week it's kind of Coppola Connections to some degree. It's a bonus episode where I will be talking to Adam Znaidy all about the music from Wes Anderson films. Because obviously on the 22nd of October, we have the release of Wes Anderson's new film, The French Dispatch. So next Tuesday, you'll be able to hear our chat where we talk about Adam's top five needle drops and music cues. So score cues from Wes Anderson films. Oh, it's a great chat. We kind of dart all around the place. We talk about how the music interplays with the films. We talk about how just kind of the music makes us feel, as well as talking about Adam's fantastic solo music project. And he's kind of got a horse in the race in the fact that he is the band leader and creator of Wes Banderson, a fantastic six-piece band who play either the Mark Mothersbaugh or Alexander Duplat score music from those films. And yeah, they've got some live shows coming up, which we talk about all in that episode. If you'd like to chuck some money in the bucket for this podcast, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod or ko-fi.com/cagedinpod and give me a little bit of your cold hard earned cash, and again it will be greatly appreciated. Over on Patreon, coming up in the next couple of months, I'll be doing a new series called Movie Brat Bros, where I'll be looking at the films of Francis Ford Coppola's mates. So that is Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma, George Lucas, all of those guys. So yeah, look out for that when that that comes. I've been a bit slack on Patreon. But yeah, it's going to be like a new show. I'm not sure whether it's going to be fortnightly or monthly. It depends how productive I can be and juggling it between this podcast and that kind of podcast. But it's going to be fun. I've been speaking to some people already, and I think you're really, 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 really going to enjoy it. So if you enjoyed this episode or any of the episodes of this podcast, please don't hesitate to head on over to Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now and leave a beautiful 5-star rating and a review. So yeah, it's always greatly appreciated. I can't tell you how much that is appreciated from me. So as always, guys, I have been Petros Patsilibus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.